Sean, we're like a month into the season, and I mean, this is the potpourri episode of the NHL At The Ring podcast. We'll have Ken Hitchcock on, going into the Hockey Hall of Fame this coming weekend. Inductions are Monday. We're recording this on Wednesday. Both of us will be there. But man, before we get to that interview with Hitch, Sean, there's a lot here. And I mean, so many different directions we can go in. But I think I want to start with the Vancouver Canucks. The 9-2-1 Vancouver Canucks, who are all over NHL.com, by the way, on this Wednesday.
They should be. I mean, we all hoped that they'd be a little bit better. They showed signs of life under Rick Tocchet, you know, at the end of last year when he was brought in. They're a completely different team this year. And you know, it starts in a couple of different areas. Thatcher Demko's healthy. You know, you look at his numbers. They played the Edmonton Oilers the other night. Edmonton dominated them early in the first period. And Thatcher Demko made five or six great saves to keep the game within reach. And then Vancouver found gear, and then it was over, you know, and everybody, after it was over, everybody talked about, oh my God, what's wrong with the Edmonton Oilers. Thatcher Demko stopped the Edmonton Oilers from finding their groove, right? And then you have Quinn Hughes and you have Besser and you know, there's pieces there, Pettersson, that make this team really dangerous, and they can score a lot of goals. But it all starts with Quinn Hughes. You know, you talk about a family right now that's dominating hockey. I mean, unfortunately, Jack's hurt at the moment. And Luke should be in the conversation for the Calder Trophy. I mean, I don't think it's a given to Bedard at this point, but it's Quinn who's just dominating right now. He's got as many points as Jack, and he's a defenseman.
I like the Canucks going into this season. We talked about this actually in a podcast we did before the season started. And I mentioned to you that, and I was pretty sure on it, but obviously you're never 100% sure. But I thought what they did at the end of last season, especially after Demko came back from his injury, Tocchet was already in there. Rick Tocchet was already in there. He was putting his systems of play in. He was putting his culture in, if you will. Then Demko came in, and that team played well. Now, it was a soft schedule, and they had nothing to play for, right? So you have to take that into account. But to me, what they've done this season at the start here is just continue from what they did at the end of last season. And yes, it starts in goal, and yes, Quinn Hughes has been great. Pettersson, all that. Right now, Sean, and I don't think this is a stretch to say, if you're looking at favorites for NHL awards a month into the season or nearly a month into the season, you're looking at potentially Elias Pettersson in the Hart Trophy conversation, obviously in the Art Ross conversation, Quinn Hughes leading the Norris conversation, Thatcher Demko maybe leading the Vezina conversation, and Rick Tocchet maybe leading the Jack Adams conversation. I mean, if we were to hand out awards right now, and we don't, they could sweep it. That's the type of start that this team has had. And when you say it starts in a number of different areas, that to me is an example of what you mean by that. There's four different examples that I'm giving you, and they all play a different role in this team for them to be as successful as they have been so far this season. There's a couple of caveats. I will get to it. But I mean, you see that, Sean, I mean, you mentioned it. It's a number of different areas. Well, I just gave you a four right there. And that, and so much comes off of those areas too. There's so many things that come about from that. JT Miller, Brock Besser, right? Philip Hronek, all these guys. It stems from those four areas though.
If you're talking awards, let's be crazy and put JT Miller in the conversation for the Selke. He's become their shutdown center. So, and look, we talk about Quinn Hughes and his 20 points. Go look at his plus minus. And again, you know, we've talked about plus minus, you know, and I could throw out the fancy stats if you want, but to me, that's an encapsulation of who they are. He's not an offensive defenseman. You know, part of being a really good defenseman is not playing in your own end. If you don't play in your own end, you don't have to worry about it, right? Like, you don't have to worry about what's happening there. You don't have to worry about how good you are in the corners, whether you can clear the front of the net. Just don't play there. And then you're the best defenseman in the league because you never have to do anything. He's been really good all over the ice, and he's on a mission. You know, it's very clear. Kevin Woodley wrote a story on NHL.com today, and you know, he was very upfront. Like, he's like, people talk about me like I don't know how to play defense. That's my job. And you know, I've done it before. You know, last year he was plus on a team that was negative all over the place. It looked like a golf tournament, you know, and he was a guy that wasn't going to make the cut on that team because he was a plus. So, you know, it really seems like he's on a mission this year to kind of prove things wrong, you know, prove his doubters wrong, and also prove that he's not the slacker in the family.
Well, he's got a lot to keep up with there for sure. I mean, Jack Hughes has been off to a great season. We'll talk about that and how the Devils overcome that injury in a little bit. We'll have Ken Hitchcock on as well. He's going to the Hockey Hall of Fame this coming weekend. Inductions are Monday. Hall of Fame weekend starts Friday. Sean and I will both be in Toronto for that. But just to throw, and it's not cold water on the Canucks start because it really isn't. But one thing that we do have to consider here is they are shooting 15.4% as a team. Okay, so what does that number mean? Well, let's put it into context. The last teams to shoot over 14% in a season were the Pittsburgh Penguins and Los Angeles Kings in 1990-91. 15.4%, Sean, and I wrote about this in my mailbag this week that's up on NHL.com. That's Edmonton Oilers 1980s level good, okay? The best we have seen in the salary cap era, so since 05-06, is the St. Louis Blues in 21-22 at 12.4%. So what it all means, my point here is that the Canucks, who are scoring 4.5 goals per game, are thriving on shooting percentage right now offensively. So it will go down. But what you love to see is how they're playing defensively and how they're keeping the puck out, how they're holding on to the puck, like you said. So while those analytic numbers, those stats will tell you that their offense will take a hit a little bit, I mean, it will regress, there's nothing to suggest that their defense should or will regress. Will they start to give up more than 2 goals per game? Probably. But they'll be fine giving up 2.5 a game. And that might be where they're at, the way that they're committed to playing defense and with the goaltending they have. Yeah, their offense is going to regress, but I think this team's in it for the long haul. And they're not just feasting on a shooting percentage that is well above the norm right now.
No, and they're not playing one goal games, but they've also played, they've won a third of their games against the Edmonton Oilers, who are giving up goals at a ridiculous pace.
Okay, so that's a great segue. Let's go there, okay?
Thank you.
Yes, I know you were looking for that segue. Let's go there. I mean, so they waived Jack Campbell they're going to put him in the AHL, right? He's in the second year of a 5-year, $25 million contract. It kind of tells you everything you need to know, right? With the Edmonton Oilers and their goaltending situation, that they're moving on for the time being from the goaltender who was supposed to be the guy that carried them forward and be the guy that was the difference that they needed in net. And he's not. Stuart Skinner right now is not. But more importantly, you watch them play and there's just holes all over the ice for the Edmonton Oilers right now. We had talked about it, Sean, right? How like this is a team that's always pushing. It's always looking for offense and always pushing. And you've got McDavid and you got Dreisaitl and they're always going to score and everything. Well, those guys don't look near as dynamic right now as they have in the past. And their defense and the lack of attention to detail on defense is just ruining them right now. And it's actually, it's, you know, what did McDavid say? It's death by 1,000 cuts. They're all defensively. They're all on defense. They're cuts. They're all without the puck when they're trying to defend until it gets to the goaltender. The goaltender is the last line and he's not doing the job, but everything in front of him is breaking down as well. And I don't know if they have within them right now to fix this the way it needs to be fixed. This isn't about, you know, going out and getting a feel good win. They did that against Calgary in the Heritage Classic, and they've lost 3 games in a row since and given up 15 goals in the process. And oh, by the way, now their next up on their schedule is the one win in a row, San Jose Sharks.
You know what? I hope later today or tomorrow or whenever it happens, when Jack Campbell goes to the AHL and finds himself in Bakersfield, that everybody else on that team looks at that and feels bad and does something about it. because it's not Jack Campbell's fault. Look, has Jack Campbell been the goalie they thought he was going to be when they paid all that money to get him? No, Ken Holland, their GM, wants more for sure. You know, and Stuart Skinner, you know, has he been as good this year as they would hope? You know, I think you started to see some holes in his game last year in the playoffs. He's pulled multiple times, but it's not his fault either. This is a team that's not helping their goalies out at all, right? And again, like, we talk about that Vancouver game, and they should have been up 3-0. Like, they were flying. They had it figured out. They were going. They were attacking. Demko made a couple of saves, and then Skinner gives up a bad goal, right? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Vancouver's up 2-1. I think they had 4 shots at that point. You know, and I understand as a team, you kind of look up at the scoreboard and you look at the iPad and you're like, what are we doing? Like, how can our margin be this thin? And I think when you lose faith in your goalies, you play differently, right? Like, you play, we got to outscore this team. We got to cut corners. And I think it's the worst thing you can possibly do. But while everybody in Edmonton sits and blames the two goalies for what's happened and says, you know, no matter what you do, you need to go find a goalie. You know, a trade needs to happen. Something needs to happen. Goalie isn't going to solve this. Like, it's way deeper. Right. There's probably 5 or 6 things that need to happen for this team to get right. And can they do it? I look, it's getting late, but I still think they can. You're talking about a team with maybe the two best players in the world. And I don't think Connor McDavid's 100% right. Ever since he got injured, he came back to play in the Heritage Classic and he looked good in that game. It seems like that explosiveness that he has is just tempered a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're hoping that he can play himself back to the level he was, and Draisaitl, obviously, you know, a supremely talented player, good complementary pieces. They're not deep enough all over the ice, and they're certainly not deep enough on defense. So there's a lot more than goaltending that needs to be fixed here.
What you said, you think it still can be done, that they can turn it around here, and I question that. I do. Like, I questioned them going into the season, partially because of the goaltending and defense. And I still, well, mainly because of the goaltending and defense. And honestly, I still, that's the reason. So I look around and I say, okay, McDavid's not right. That's pretty obvious, I think, at this point. I mean, they're scoring 2.64 goals per game. They're not outscoring their problems right now. Okay. They were able to survive at times when they were outscoring their own problems. They're not doing that. Their power play, okay, it's 25%. That's great. That's not 33% or right around where it was last year. That's a drop, okay? But I look around and I go, why do we believe that they're going to turn it around? What do they have other than McDavid and Draisaitl, who, yes, they can get hot and they can go on a heater and help this team go win, you know, on a 6 or 7 game heater. But what else is there right now that's screaming to you to say, man, this is just a bad start. They're going to be fine. They're going to turn it around. The defense, they don't have a standout on the blue line, right? They don't have that guy. They don't have a standout in net. And their depth, as you said, is not great. It's not. I mean, they're lacking in depth too. So I look at it and I say, this is a team built around two superstars. And those superstars have carried them for a long way right now. In previous seasons, it's hard to do, especially if one of those superstars, at least one, is compromised.
Yeah, look, I'm not saying it's going to be easy, and I'm not saying it's going to happen. The Vegas Golden Knights and the Los Angeles Kings have not helped them at all. They've ran away and hid. We're talking double digits already. We're a month into the season. Edmonton's double digits out in their division. They're basically, barring an in fuego situation that's hard to imagine, they're playing for a wild card.
Already.
A month into the season.
Hey, listen, hey, you know who's also not helping them out right now? The Anaheim Ducks. The Anaheim Ducks are playing well. They're finding ways to get points, okay? It's there's a long way to go here for Edmonton. I think we need to be honest with this and say they've played, what, 11, 12 games, and they're double digits out of the top 3 spot in that division. That's not just a heater. That's a cold spell for top teams in the league in order to get back to it. And, Sean, I mean, we're talking now on November 8th. Counting them out would be ridiculous at this point because there's so much of the season left. But it's really hard to see a path to the top 3. And then you have other teams who are building their games and building their themselves up a little bit here, it's easier to see a path to a wild card. But I just don't see a reason to say, yeah, the Edmonton Oilers are going to figure this out.
Well, they have in the past. I mean, that's the reason. They've been a good regular season team for a couple of years now. The warts have been exposed in the playoffs because it's a long series. They've been really cold. They can get really hot. And then, you know, it kind of evens themselves out. And then they play the rest of the season hoping to play 600 hockey, right? Like once they get back to where they need to be. And can a team like Edmonton do that? Yeah, I think they can. Can a team like Calgary do that? Who was their opponent in the Heritage Classic, who just benched their superstar in Huberto, Jonathan Huberto. He didn't play in the third period of the game last night, you know, and they've struggled all over the ice as well. And they positioned themselves in the Heritage Classic as it being a must-win game to get their season going. And then they lost and they've backed themselves into a corner and they were going to lose last night. They were down 2-1 and they ended up winning a big third period comeback, of which Jonathan Huberto, their highest paid player, had no part in.
You're like the king of the segue today. By the way,
I'm trying. I'm on my game.
You really are, because, and not only that, we're on the same wavelength, because that's where I was going next before we get to, and I wanted to, we obviously, we spoke to Ken Hitchcock, another Alberta guy, by the way, going into the Hockey Hall of Fame. But before we get there, I wanted to talk Calgary, and you just jump right there. Look at you, the king of the segue today. You're on your ball. You're on your game. You're on it. So stay on it. We go to Toronto this weekend. You need to stay on your game.
Yeah, well, when we're in Toronto, I'm going to SiriusXM and I'm applying for a job.
Well, there you go. We're going to lose you now. Okay, I see how it works. But you mentioned, like, look, Huberto benched third period. They were down 2-0 in that game against Nashville. They come back and win 4-2 with the 3 goals in the third period. Huberto's stat line in that game before being benched, he played a little over 14 minutes, no shots, 2 giveaways, right? I mean, this guy's in year two of the 8-year contract he's on right now. $84 million contract. He had 115 points with the Florida Panthers a couple of years ago. Gets traded. 55 points in his first year in Calgary. We're going to put a little bit of the blame on the coach, right? He couldn't adjust to Daryl Sutter's system. He couldn't play the way he wanted to be able to play there. Big summer, big offseason. Huberto's back. Ryan Huska's the coach. Everything's going to be different now. He's going to back up, maybe not 115-point player, but he's going to be a 90-point player, a 95-point player. And again, he's got 6 points in 12 games. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. And the Calgary Flames and Ryan Huska, basically, he didn't outright say it after the game against Nashville, but he basically said all he needed to say by benching Huberto for the third period, that he'd had enough. He had enough of watching a guy who's supposed to be a dominant playmaker not be a dominant playmaker. And it's an issue. It's a big problem in Calgary. Now, they've won their past 2 games. Other things in their game are maybe starting to build a little bit, but they're not going anywhere unless this guy gets himself going. And we're now talking about not just a full season last year. We're talking about an eighth of a season this year as well. So it's bled through into this season. And like Edmonton, I mean, what's telling us, if anything, that Jonathan Huberto can turn it around in Calgary?
Again, it's track record, but his confidence is in shambles right now. I mean, what happened to him last year? He had to completely change his game, you know, and he said he spent the summer trying to get back to what he is, which is, you know, more of an east-west player than a straight north-south player, which is what Daryl asked him to do. But the one difference in Calgary is they have a Vezina-level goalie in Jacob Markstrom, right? He can cover some sins as they try and figure out their offense. But you know what I really like, Dan? And this will get us into Hitchcock in a minute, and this is, I think, another good segue. You can let me know, because you seem to be the arbiter of these things.
Before you segue, I wanted to... Markstrom, 2-6-1, a 2.91 goals against average, and an .896 save percentage so far this season, okay? He's not playing as bad as those numbers would suggest. I think he's playing better than that. But Markstrom last season, .892 save percentage, 2.92 goals against average. Is he still a Vezina-level goaltender?
No, but he can be.
He has been.
He has that ability, I think. He needs some help. You know, just like the guys in Edmonton need some help, he needs some help. And I think when things go bad and margins get so thin, it wears on a goalie, right? Like you look at goalies and they feel like they have to be perfect. and that leads to more mistakes. They become hyper aggressive. So Calgary was giving up crazy high danger shots, right? And that's the thing in Edmonton too. Like sometimes you look at the shots and you're like, well, Edmonton didn't give up that many shots, but they gave up 27 shots and 13 of them were high danger shots, right? You're talking, and that's superhuman for any goalie. And then one that's struggling, my God. But what I wanted to get to is coaching. We're going to talk to Ken Hitchcock, one of the best coaches ever to play the game. That's why he's going in the Hall of Fame. There's some new coaches in the league this year. Husk is one of them in Calgary. Pascal Vincent's another one in Columbus. And you know what? They're not afraid. We're talking multi-million dollar superstars. Husk set Huberto last night. Mm-hmm. Not good enough. Go sit at the end of the bench. I don't want to deal with it. Vincent, who's waited his whole life to be a coach, and you would think wouldn't want to rock the boat at all, says to Johnny Gaudreau, go sit. I don't want to deal with you. You're not playing good enough. Both times, when it was over, there was no rhetoric. There was nothing. Last night, Ryan Huska said, wasn't his night. We'll come back. He'll be good to go. Johnny Gaudreau, we had a discussion. I told him what I thought. He told me what he thought. We're all good. Gaudreau played top minutes the next night in Florida in a crazy game that they ended up losing. That was not a good game to lose after, you know, they had made this huge comeback. But I love that these new coaches have come in and they've said, you don't run the show. Players don't run the show. I run the show. And when we talk to Hitch in a minute, he'll talk a little bit about Bob Gainey and how Bob Gainey backed him very early in his career and gave him the confidence to do the things that he needed to do to be the coach that he wanted to be. And I love seeing that in our game right now.
Well, I mean, the one thing, the one hammer that the coach has is he controls your playing time. He controls your ice time. He controls how much you're out there. And it's a huge hammer. And you're right. It's really cool to see guys who were in their first year as NHL coaches swinging that hammer on superstar players. Ken Hitchcock swung that hammer a bunch as well on a lot of superstar players that he coached. He's going into the Hockey Hall of Fame this coming weekend. Friday is the ring ceremony. Saturday is fan forum, which is always an awesome time at the Hall of Fame. Sunday is the Legends game. Monday is the inductions. Here's our interview with Ken Hitchcock. Ken, thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on the Hockey Hall of Fame. And I'm curious for you, does it symbolize a career in hockey or a life in hockey?
I would say both, to be honest with you, but it's more a life in hockey. My background goes way back to minor hockey days, both as a player and as a coach. And my dad was a coach, and I've been in hockey, it feels like forever. And I've covered almost every aspect between coaching minor hockey to the NHL. So I feel like it's been a lifetime also, you know, a journey.
Obviously, everybody growing up dreams of playing hockey, but I'm curious with your dad being involved in coaching and everything else, was coaching something that you always knew that you would do?
You know what, fellas, like other than Gordie Howe, my heroes were all coaches. And it was because of my dad. And he worked for Imperial Oil. And then part-time, he ran the rink shack in the two communities I grew up in. And he coached both midget and juvenile, sometimes both teams in the same calendar year. And so I would follow him around all the time. So we were watching, back in Edmonton days, we were watching the Edmonton Flyers, the Oil Kings, the Junior B Red Wings. We would watch practices, and he knew a lot of the coaches. And then I got to know the coaches in Alberta. And so my heroes are Dave King, and you know, Glenn Sather and John Muckler. They were my heroes more than even players were.
Is that something that doesn't necessarily happen anymore in the coaching fraternity, that people could be coaching lifers but they don't necessarily dream about coaching? Or do you know people that is the case right now, and maybe they're not in the NHL, they're just people that are coaching in other leagues and other levels? Is it something that you still know about and you still see, or is it sort of a thing of the past that when you're not dreaming necessarily, and your idols are not the guys who are skating on the ice, they're the guys who are the tacticians behind the bench?
I think those days are gone now, to be honest with you, there, because it's such a long climb. You know, I made it as a lifestyle choice and enjoyed it every step of the way. And I had no indication, or I had no goals, to be honest with you. I didn't have a goal of coaching in the National Hockey League. My only goal was how much I loved coaching, how much I loved teaching, how much I really loved building teams. That was my goal, and wherever it took me. And if it meant I, in order to coach, I had to do three or four different jobs, I did it. I did it because of the teaching and the team building part of it. And I didn't want to ever let go of that feeling.
With that said, I mean, obviously you made it to the NHL. Do you remember like your welcome to the NHL moment?
Do I ever? In January of 1996, Bob Gainey told me that looking for a coach, and I was his choice. I had to get from Kalamazoo to Dallas because they were playing the next day. Game was against Scotty and Detroit, and Scotty never gave us a puck for 60 minutes. And it was an eye-opener. First of all, the speed of the game, the physicality of the game, the execution of the game was at a level I'd never seen before. Even when I was an assistant coach, I couldn't believe Detroit was the top team at that time, but it was real eye-opener for me at tempo and speed and how things had to get my thinking up to a whole other level.
You mentioned the name there, Ken, Bob Gainey, and what, and I know he's meant a lot to you in your NHL coaching career, and he gave you the start there. I'm curious, just, you know, what is it about Bob Gainey that means so much to you? What kind of impact, if you can describe it, did he have on you?
Bob and I are very close, and my back, you know, and every endeavor I tried, I was going to take some risks when dealing with the players, and he supported me 100%. And that knowledge that came from playing for the Montreal Canadiens, he passed that knowledge on to me and being able to pass it on to other guys. But that way that I've always used the term, he can see around corners, and so much respect for him. And he's one of those guys that can see around corners. But, you know, 12 years in professional hockey, Gainey, Doug Armstrong, and Clark, it doesn't get any better than that, fellas. Helped me so much, those three guys.
Look, it's mutual. I mean, we have up today, as a matter of fact, on NHL.com, the profile that we did on you, but also a testimonial from Bob Gainey, you know, about what you've meant to him and the impact that you've had. So it's definitely a mutual admiration society. I wanted to ask you about another piece that's on there today that Adam Kimmelman did. You talked about giving back, and he wrote an amazing piece. I think it was during the lockout where you helped coach at Princeton and several other places. And I know you've had like coaches coffee things where you've helped other coaches out, both at the NHL level and other levels. How important has it been for you, not only during your career, but now, you know, that you're in a different stage of it, to be able to pass on those lessons that other people have imparted onto you?
It's critical. You know, I started going to coaching clinics in the late 70s. You're getting all this information every summer and going to the clinics, whether it's Red Deer, Calgary, Edmonton, doesn't matter. You're always there, Hitch, and you're learning, but be able to turn that back and pass it on. And he said part of the deal is that you're got to be one of the guys that passes it on. And I really took that to heart, guys. Share, you know, technical packages and everything to help other guys be successful.
Hitch, how was it for you in terms of adapting to players through your years as a coach, especially as a head coach? I mean, the players that you came in with are not the players that you went out with, if you will. What was that like for you? Did you have to adapt? Did you have to change? Or was it your message and your principles pretty steady throughout?
I worked really hard in adapting. So I would spend the summer talking to five or six junior coaches, college coaches, to understand what the mindset was, because they were coaching that younger group of players, and I wanted to know what was going on. And being able to adapt for me was providing the players with information solicited the commitment. And that's what changed for me, is that you had to You had to tell them what the end game was to the beginning. And that was a huge change. And that was something that I really had to challenge myself to adapt to. Rather than just information, this is what we're doing, I had to discuss what was in it for them and the benefits for them before I thought that they could buy in and complete the sale.
And a lot of that, I would think, you know, went beyond hockey, right? You're known as such a hockey lifer and X's and O's, and that's all great. But in a way, you're a leader, right? And I get the sense in doing some research and talking to some people about you that that part of it really interested you, whether it was other sports and talking to coaches there or business leaders or whoever it was. You're really a CEO of a company.
I really took teaching to heart, whether it was in the NFL, Major League Baseball, Hungarian handball, basketball teams. I really took to heart why organizations were successful. I owed that to my players to be on the cutting edge of things if I wanted my team to continue to improve.
Please tell me you have a Hungarian handball story.
I went to Budapest and watched them train for 2 days. I've been with NFL teams. I've been with Major League Baseball teams. Most from that program. The timing was of practice and how the drills were exact and you had to be at a high level and the demands placed on the player. I was amazed by it.
That's pretty amazing that it goes all the way back to Hungarian handball to get yourself situated for an NHL coaching job. I mean, it really kind of brings full circle the coaching aspect of what this is now. I mean, can you give an example of just sort of like how you incorporated some of what you saw there into an NHL practice?
The handball and the NFL and with Andy's team in particular with the Eagles and then later on with the Chiefs learned that the time you spend practicing game-like situations, the better your team's going to be. Practice every scenario possible on perfect timing. There was no delay. There was no whiteboard and meetings. It was go at a tempo we're going to play at. In that are actual game-like situations or competition-like situations, and let's go from there. And I learned a lot from both of those programs.
That's amazing, and you've passed on a lot, and now it all comes full circle. You get a very just reward in your induction into the Hockey Hall of Fame, starting with the ring ceremony on Friday through the weekend, and then the induction on Monday. It's always a special time, and we're really happy you could join us before that happened, and congratulations again on a great honor.
Truly appreciate it, guys.
We thank Hitch for joining us. He'll be on his way to Toronto shortly, as will we, Sean, for Hall of Fame weekend, as will the other inductees, Henrik Lundqvist, Mike Vernon, Tom Barrasso, three goalies going in, Pierre Turgeon as well, Caroline Ouellette, Hitch, of course, and posthumously, Pierre Lacroix, who obviously guided the Colorado Avalanche to their two Stanley Cup championships, 1996 and 2001. It's a seven-person class. It's a pretty elite class. And I think, Sean, of the players, the most elite of the elite is probably, it's got to be, it's Henrik Lundqvist, right? I mean, this has to be like the Lundqvist class, if you will. And that's no offense to Barrasso and Vernon and Turgeon and Caroline Ouellette, but Henrik Lundqvist is the one that he's the face of the class, if you will.
And what a face it is.
Oh, yeah.
You know better than I. I mean, I covered him his whole career to a level, but you covered him on a day-to-day basis. You wrote the profile, which is excellent, on NHL.com. His brother wrote the testimonial. One of the great things, by the way, for the listeners that I think that NHL.com does really well, and I don't want to toot our horn over anybody else, but as far as Hall of Fame coverage goes, something that we started doing a few years ago and has been excellent is having the inductees either pick somebody to write a testimonial about why they're Hall of Famers or figuring out who that person can be. You had Hank's brother do it, and you know, it's fantastic. The best one we had this time around was for Tom Barrasso. Emily Benjamin wrote his profile, and she said to him, who would you like to write the testimonial? And he said, Mario Lemieux would be great. Sure, we'll just have Mario do it. You know, he's in the public all the time. Mario did it himself. No ghostwriting, nothing. wrote it, sent it in, said, here's the testimonial. And basically it was, we don't win without Tom Barrasso. It was what I wish from every writer on our staff. It was concise. It was to the point. There was no flower. It was basically, we do not win without Tom Barrasso.
Are you suggesting that Mario does something better than I do?
He does a lot of things better.
He does a lot of things better than I do. No, it is a great thing. And Joel Lundqvist, Henrik's twin brother, who is a legend, by the way, in Sweden with Frölunda, their team growing up. He did the testimonial for Henrik Lundqvist, and it was very interesting to hear from Joel and what he was talking about in his testimonial about them being kids and growing up and together. And Henrik talked a lot about that too. We know what the player is, right? I mean, we see what the player is when he is in the NHL or international, or in Caroline Ouellette's case, you know, starring on the international level in the women's game and being a trailblazer in the women's game. We see that player, but to learn where they come from, and Hitch talked about it a little bit in the interview we had, and for Henrik to learn, you know, talking to him where he came from and how he, you know, they first went, his dad took him and his brother to their first hockey game when they were 5 years old, and it was the Frölunda game in Gothenburg, and they didn't grow up near Gothenburg. It was like an 8 to 10 hour drive. They flew and they became instant fans there, and then they wrote letters. They were like us growing up, you know what I mean? They wrote letters to the players and to the team, and they got letters and autographs back from the team, and they became instant fans. And one of the cool things that Lundqvist talked about is we talk a lot about the dream of playing in the NHL, and you know, a lot of players now want to get here. They want, like, that's the goal, and they want to get here as quick as they can. Lundqvist wasn't like that. His first dream was to play for Frölunda in the Swedish Hockey League, to play for Team Sweden. He started to get the opportunity when he was a teenager, 16 years old. He didn't want to rush it. Now, he wasn't a number one pick. He wasn't a first-round draft pick. He was a seventh-round draft pick. But it wasn't really until he was able to do things for the team he grew up rooting for, his favorite team, that he started to then think about the National Hockey League and maybe at that level. Now, one doesn't happen without the other, right? He doesn't do those things for Frölunda. He probably doesn't get a chance, a sniff at the NHL, but he did. He gets the sniff. He comes in and he dominates the league for almost two decades. And who knows, might still be playing right now, by the way, if not for his heart issue. But I thought it was really cool to hear the backstory of who he was and where he came from. And we get a lot of this with the Hall of Fame profiles before they got to stardom in the National Hockey League.
And he's going to play on Sunday. Like, it really did get cut short. There wasn't that moment right for him. He showed up at camp and they said, whoa, you know, and with the Capitals, they said, whoa, you can't play. Like, there was never that moment where you said, this is the end. And it's not going to be the same because it's a one-off game seen by, you know, maybe three quarters of a full building, not much of a TV audience. But for me, it's that last chance as a goalie guy to see Hank strap on the pads and play in a semi-serious game, if I'm being kind.
Well, yeah, semi-serious is 100% right. One other thing to add to that with the Hall of Fame, Sean, is, and this is personal for me, growing, you know, living in the area we live in and, you know, me being around the Rangers every once in a while, my son, Josh, who's 14 now, Henrik Lundqvist was his first sports idol. He really was. Like, I remember years ago, he was doing an assignment in school, and it was like, you know, who would you invite to your Thanksgiving dinner? And he wrote a thing about inviting Henrik Lundqvist to his Thanksgiving dinner. And I was able to actually show that to Henrik in the locker room after a game, after a win, by the way. I wouldn't have showed it to him after a loss. And he thought it was really cool. And he did a project actually earlier this year in school about, you know, the sports idol and, you know, somebody who got him into an appreciation for sports and wanting to be in the sports business. And it wasn't his dad, me, it was Henrik Lundqvist. Right. So Josh and my family are coming up with, you know, to Toronto. And one of the cool things is he wants to just be around Hall of Fame weekend to see a guy like Henrik Lundqvist get inducted. He won't be there Monday night to see him get inducted. He'll watch it on TV, but he's just really excited about his first time at the Hall of Fame and getting that opportunity. That's what I think we tend to forget as we talk about the Flames and the Oilers and the Canucks and all that, you know, guys like this, that's what, you know, it means so much for kids too. And It's just really cool. He's going to get that chance.
This is such a hard business at times, and you know, it really wears on you in certain ways, whether it's the travel or the negativity or whatever, but you always try and look through those kids' eyes, and it'll be cool to be around Josh and to be able to see that excitement and see what made you want to do this in the first place, right? Like, it, we all love the game. The game's a huge part of each of us. Sadly, sometimes we forget it. And Hall of Fame weekend is a great time to remember it, because you remember, I remember hearing stories about Tom Barrasso when I was a kid. When I first put on the pads, he grew up not that far away from me in Acton, Boxborough, right across the Mass line from Rhode Island. And you'd hear stories about this prodigy, and then there he was in the NHL. So again, it's a great, great weekend.
Yeah, it definitely is. So that's coming up. Before we get out of here, though, a couple other topics that are going on in the league right now we need to talk about. Number one, the New Jersey Devils, Sean. So we talked about Quinn Hughes at the top of the show. We talked about his brother Luke a little bit, and we brought up Jack and his injury. And I had mentioned that we're going to talk about the Devils. We do have to talk about the Devils and Jack's injury. I mean, he's week to week with an upper body injury right now. I got a question in my weekly mailbag about the Devils. And the question literally was, can they survive without Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier? Yeah, they can survive, Sean, but they're going to have to, and they're in the process of, and I think this could be a positive for them if you want to look at the glass half full approach. They're going to have to change a little bit about their approach. There can't be as much of a freewheeling run and gun team. They're not going to always have the best player on the ice for the first however many games this season, and most of the games they played last season, they had the best player on the ice, the most dangerous player on the ice. They do not now without Jack Hughes, and the Devils are going to have to figure out ways to protect their goalies, to play better in front of them, and understand that they can't fly the zone and expect the offense to always come, because he's the offense driver. They still have other guys. I mean, Bratt, you know, Meyer, Toffoli, Mercer, they got a lot of guys that can score, but it all centers around Jack Hughes. This could be a positive for the Devils if they can survive this time and stay afloat, which they should be able to do, because it could teach them or show them the structure they need to have within their game. And then when Jack comes back, they can play within that structure and still have the game breaker.
Yeah, I think all of that's true. I'm just really sad because I think that Jack was in the midst of what could have been a really special year, right? Like a Connor McDavid type of season. And now that MVP race is wide open. Connor's not playing as well. Jack Hughes is hurt. You know, Austin Matthews is just completely on fire. Kucherov, for that game between Tampa and Toronto awesome. On Monday was just amazing, right? Yep. The offensive talent that was scattered across that ice. So, and look, I mean, the Devils at times have no right to even be in games. Mike McLeod's their number one center. Yeah. He's a great player. Like, look, I'm not going to say anything against him. Kid can win faceoffs. He can play first line. He can play fourth line. He can do whatever you want. But can you think of another team that we're talking about serious, serious aspirations for that has a Mike McLeod caliber player as their first line center?
No. But that's what happens when you have Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier not in the lineup, right? It's obvious, but that's why I'm saying that if they do it right, if they do this right, the Devils are going to be a better team coming out of this than they are going into it. And Jack is going to be Jack when he comes back. He's going to be a dynamic, awesome player. We know that, right? But if he can be that dynamic, awesome player and the Devils have a little bit more structure than they've had at the start of this season, even Tommy Fitzgerald, their GM, has said it, like, we can't put anything on the goalie. We got to protect our goalies better. Then I think that they will be a better team and a more dangerous team, especially come February, March, and April, when it really matters. When these games get tighter, the Devils have to play it tighter, and they haven't shown necessarily that ability to do that. And they don't have they're not as big on defense as they were last year. That size is not the same. So there's a lot of things here, and they can use this to, if they use it the right way, they may take some bumps along the road, but if they use this the right way, I think they're a better team coming out of it.
I agree. They won't be better standings-wise, but I think it'll pay off when the season gets tight.
And the last thing, Sean, I wanted to touch on as well is Patrick Kane could be, according to Elliot Friedman, and it's about that time now as we're approaching a couple of weeks away from U.S. Thanksgiving. Patrick Kane narrowing his list of teams. He's been skating for a while. The 4 to 6 month timeline from his surgery on June 1st, we're in that window. I remember chatting with his agent not long ago, and he was saying, you know, he didn't want to really put a timeline on it, but, you know, sometime between Thanksgiving and Christmas is when you're looking for Patrick Kane to get back on the ice. I just think what's happened with Nicklas Backstrom, same surgery, same age, basically, as having the surgery, the hip resurfacing surgery. And we now see Nicklas Backstrom is done for the season, put on LTIR, has to take a leave from the team because of his injury situation. It just gives me pause on if Patrick Kane's going to be able to come back and be the guy that he, or even closely resemble the player that he was previous to this. Remember, this hip had been nagging him for a long time. And then he had the surgery, hip resurfacing surgery. Ed Jovanovski was the first to have it. He came back from it after an 8 or 9 month recovery period. He played 37 games and retired. Nicklas Backstrom had it, played a 39 games, I think, last year, got through it, felt 100% in the offseason, not so much as the season started. It's a big ask for Patrick Kane, and I think that's going to be really interesting because teams are going to take chances on him. They're going to want him, but I think you have to go in with a little hesitation as well.
Yeah, look, Patrick Kane can't be a savior at this point. Anybody that's looking at him as the guy who's going to save their season, I think, is going to be sorely disappointed. Can he be a complimentary piece? Can you hope you catch lightning in a bottle and do it for a relatively low cost? Not money-wise, but asset-wise, right? Because it's right. Only going to cost you money. And, you know, while I might be unable to balance my budget, money's not a big deal to NHL teams. I could always use a little more. So if anybody wants to send me some, that's fine. But that's all you're wasting as an NHL team, and you can waste that. Like, that's a disposable asset. But I certainly have concerns. But I think if you're a team that thinks you're good and thinks you can contend and you can spot Patrick Kane, you know, give him some power play time, give him some time, you know, not a lot of heavy minutes. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're able to coax him across the finish line in relatively good health. I don't think you can ride Patrick Kane like a number one anymore.
You know, it's interesting, too, before we get out of here, one of the teams that keep getting talked about with Kane is the Carolina Hurricanes, and you can see the need, but honestly, I don't know if the fit is there with the way the Hurricanes play and the way Rod Brind'Amour, you know, has that, you know, that system and that style. You always have to adjust to the way they play. I'm not sure I see the fit there, especially with Kane coming off of this surgery.
I think anybody can fit in Carolina. I think they're a lot like the New England Patriots were in their prime. Not like they are now, but like they were in their prime. You know, people went in there and you were like, how can that guy go in there? He doesn't fit personality-wise. He doesn't fit systems-wise. He doesn't fit any way. That locker room makes you fit, and it starts with Rod Brind'Amour. He makes people fit. You look at Tony D'Angelo, you look at other players that have gone in there, and you kind of shrugged your shoulders and said, I don't see it. And then all of a sudden, they're perfectly integrated into the system. Brent Burns was another one, right? There were questions when he came in. Is he really going to fit that system? He's a supremely talented player, but is he what they need? And clearly, he just fit right in. So Patrick Kane can't play goal. That's what Carolina needs right now.
Well, I mean, they Freddie Anderson's out with the blood clots, and we wish him the best in his recovery from that. We don't know the timeline there, but they do have Antti Raanta. They do have Pyotr Kochetkov, and they signed Yaro Halak to a PTO. And I'll tell you right now, the Edmonton Oilers will take any one of those three guys right now. Okay, so there is that. You have to look at the other side of it sometimes.
Look, it's going to be interesting. We're going to Florida. I wish we were going to Florida.
Wish
it's much
we were.
Warmer. We're going to Toronto, the center of hockey, for a celebration of hockey this week. It's going to be fantastic. GM meetings at the end of it. And then we come back and we get into that holiday season, right? Thanksgiving's right around the corner. And then Christmas and the New Year right behind it. The Winter Classic, all those things coming up. This is where the rubber really starts to hit the road and where we really find out who teams are and what they're about. And I'm so excited to see some of the teams that we talked about hopefully get a little better and see what some of those surprising teams like Detroit, like Anaheim, and teams like that, whether or not they can continue to do what they've done for more than a month now. Like you said earlier, it's not a heater anymore. This is maybe who they are.
Yeah, we're getting to that point where this is who they are. We'll be up at Toronto for Hall of Fame weekend. We'll have some reaction to that next week, and a lot of hockey coming your way. Enjoy it all. Enjoy the hockey.